Good evening. The Attorney General is grilled before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and May Day heats up around the world. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for May Day, International Workers' Day, May 1st, 2019. International Workers' Day was celebrated by thousands in protests and in some cases riots around the world on Wednesday. In Turkey, Istanbul police detained 137 people for trying to hold demonstrations declared illegal in various parts of the city. Squares belong to the people. They cannot be closed off, the protesters chanted as they tried to reach central Taksim Square, where police had cordoned off the approaching streets. In Madrid, Spain, workers called on the new socialist-led government for pension increases and a rollback of anti-labor legislation. But in Paris, masked and hooded anarchists clashed with riot police, burning bins, smashing property, and hurling bottles and rocks, hijacking a rally focused on protesting President Emmanuel Macron's policies. Police used tear gas to disperse protesters, and they made nearly 400 arrests. Meanwhile, in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela, thousands turned out at the presidential palace to support President Nicolas Maduro a day after a United States-backed coup failed to topple the elected government. The large pro-government rally dwarfed a tiny group that gathered at the urging of coup leader Juan Guaido in a wealthy part of town. Meanwhile, Representative Ilhan Omar is criticizing the bipartisan support in Congress for the Venezuelan opposition leader. The Minnesota Democrat said on Democracy Now!, "You know, I mean, a lot of the policies that we have put in place has kind of helped lead the devastation in Venezuela, and we've sort of set the stage for where we're arriving today." Omar's opposition to regime change comes after the United States and dozens of other Western nations declared Guaido the legitimate leader of Venezuela. In the Philippines, thousands gathered to protest the government of Rodrigo Duterte, burning his effigy in the middle of Manila, the capital of the country. A protester explained why they opposed Duterte.
Duterte administration is totally anti-worker, anti-people, because they deny the legitimate demands of the working class, working people, about the ending of contractualizations and about the issue of additional wages for the Filipino workers.
Violent clashes also marked May Day rallies in Turin and Milan, Italy, while tear gas wafted through the streets of Lyon, France's second city, as well as Berlin and Athens. Huge crowds rallied peacefully in London. In the United States, anarchists and radicals clashed with cops in Seattle, Washington. Garbage cans were set on fire and police sprayed tear gas on demonstrators. There was also violence in Portland, Oregon, where cops used pellet guns to force back anarchists and other mass demonstrators. And in New York City, hundreds of peaceful protesters are planning to celebrate May Day with a walkout beginning at the new school. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., Attorney General William Barr on Wednesday defended his decision to clear President Donald Trump of criminal obstruction of justice at the Senate Judiciary Committee. Trump has been accused but not charged with attempting to impede Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia inquiry, but Barr remained steadfast, criticizing Mueller for not reaching a conclusion of his own on the issue. One of the issues during the contentious hearing was why White House Counsel Don McGahn refused to follow Trump's order to fire Mueller. He was grilled by California Democrat Dianne Feinstein.
The special counsel's report describes how the president directed White House counsel Don McGahn to fire special counsel Mueller and later told McGahn to write a letter, quote, "for our records," end quote, stating that the president had not ordered him to fire Mueller. The report also recounts how the president made repeated efforts to get McGahn to change his story. Knowing that McGahn believed the president's version of events was false, the special counsel found, and I quote, substantial evidence, end quote, that the president tried to change McGahn's account in order to prevent further scrutiny of the president towards the investigation. Special counsel also found that McGahn is a credible witness with no motive to lie or exaggerate given the position he held in the White House. Here's the question. Does existing law prohibit efforts to get a witness to lie, to say something the witness believes is false?
Yes. And lie to the government, yes.
And what law is that?
Obstruction statutes.
The obstruction statute. And you don't have it, I guess, before you.
Well, I'm not sure which one they were referring to here. It was probably 1512 C2.
So these things, in effect, constitute obstruction.
Well, you're talking in general terms. You're not talking.
What I'm talking about specifically, yes, you're correct in a sense that the special counsel in his report found substantial evidence that the president tried to change McGahn's account in order to prevent, and this is a quote, further scrutiny of the president toward the investigation, end quote. The special counsel also found McGahn is a credible witness with no motive to lie or exaggerate. So what I'm asking you then, is that a credible charge under the obstruction statute?
We felt that that episode, the government would not be able to establish obstruction. If you look at the episode where the president gave McGahn an instruction, McGahn's version of that is quite clear, and each time he gave it, which is that the instruction said, go to Rosenstein, raise the issue of conflict of interest, and Mueller has to go because of this conflict of interest. So there's no question that whatever instruction was giving McGahn had to do with Mueller's conflict of interest. Now, the president later said that what he meant was that the conflict of interest should be raised with Rosenstein, but the decision should be left with Rosenstein. On the other end of the spectrum, it appears that McGahn felt it was more directive and that the president was essentially saying, push Rosenstein to invoke a conflict of interest to push Mueller out. Wherever it fell on that spectrum of interest, the New York Times story was very different. The New York Times story said flat out that the president directed the firing of Mueller. He told McGahn, fire Mueller. Now, that there's something very different between firing a special counsel outright, which suggests ending the investigation, and having a special counsel removed for conflict, which suggests that you're going to have another special counsel. So the fact is that even under McGahn's and then, as the report says and recognizes, there is evidence the president truly felt that the Times article was inaccurate and he wanted McGahn to correct it. So we believe that it would be impossible for the government to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that the president understood that he was instructing McGahn to say something false, because it wasn't necessarily false. Moreover, McGahn had weeks before already given testimony to the special counsel, and the president was aware of that. And as the report indicates, it could also have been the case that he was primarily concerned about press reports and making it clear that he never outright directed the firing of Mueller. So in terms of the request to ask McGahn to memorialize that fact, we do not think in this case that the government could show corrupt intent beyond a reasonable doubt.
Just to finish this, but you still have a situation where a president essentially tries to change the lawyer's account in order to prevent further criticism of himself.
Well, that's not a crime.
So you can, in this situation, instruct someone to lie?
No, it has to be, well, to be obstruction of justice, the lie has to be tied to impairing the evidence in a particular proceeding. McGahn had already given his evidence, and I think it would be plausible that the purpose of McGahn memorializing what the president was asking was to make the record that the president never directed him to fire. And there is a distinction between saying to someone, go fire Mueller, and saying, have him removed based on conflict.
And what would
they have different results?
What would that conflict be?
Well, the difference between them is if you remove someone for a conflict of interest, then there would be presumably another person appointed.
Another issue raised was Tuesday's bombshell revelation that Mueller had spoken with Barr after the release of a four-page letter by the Attorney General that downplayed Mueller's findings on obstruction.
We're going to split the time between Senator Klobuchar and Senator Blumenthal.
I said, are the president's actions detailed in the report consistent with his oath of office and the requirement in the Constitution that he take care that the laws be faithfully executed?
The evidence in the report is conflicting, and there's different evidence, and they don't come to a determination as to how they're coming down on it.
And so you made that decision.
Yes, and as you know, if it's if
we, all right, we got
okay.
2 minutes left, Senator Blumenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Attorney General Barr, I wonder if you could tell us about the conversation between yourself and Bob Mueller shortly after your summary was issued. He called you?
No, I called him.
What prompted you to call him?
The letter.
Your letter? Or his letter?
His letter.
His letter. So you called him?
Yeah.
And how long did the conversation last?
I don't know, maybe 10, 15 minutes. There were multiple witnesses in the room. It was on the speakerphone.
Who was in the room?
Among others, the Deputy Attorney General was in the room.
Anyone else?
Yeah, several other people who had been working on the project.
Members of your staff?
Yes, and the deputy staff.
And as best you can recall, in the language that was used, who said what to whom?
I said, Bob, what's with the letter? You know, why don't you just pick up the phone and call me if there's an issue? And he said that they were concerned about the way the media was playing this and felt that it was important to get out the summaries, which they felt would put their work in proper context. Avoid some of the confusion that was emerging. And I asked him if he felt that my letter was misleading or inaccurate. And he said no, that the press, he felt that the press coverage was, and it was, and that a more complete picture of his thoughts and the context and so forth would deal with that. And I suggested that I would rather just get the whole report out than just putting out stuff seriatim and piecemeal. But I said I would think about it some more. And the next day I put out a letter that made it clear that no one should read the March 24th letter as a summary of the overall report, and that a full account of Bob's, Mueller's thinking was going to be in the report and everyone would have access to.
But there's nothing in Robert Mueller's letter to you about the press. His complaint to you is about your characterization of the report, correct?
Well, the letter speaks for itself.
It does. And in fact, in response to your question, why not just pick up the phone? This letter was an extraordinary act. A career prosecutor rebuking the Attorney General of the United States, memorializing in writing, right? I know of no other instance of that happening. Do you?
I don't consider Bob at this stage a career prosecutor. He's had a career as a prosecutor.
Well, he's a very eminent prosecutor.
He was the head of the FBI for 12 years.
He's a career.
He's had a
law enforcement career, yeah. Professional.
Right.
Yep. I know of no other instance of.
But he was also a political appointee, and he was a political appointee with me at the Department of Justice. The letter's a bit snitty, and I think it was probably written by one of his staff people.
Did you make a memorandum of your conversation?
Huh?
Did you make a memorandum?
No, I didn't.
Or did anyone else?
What?
Did anyone, either you or anyone on your staff, memorialize your conversation with Robert Mueller?
Yes.
Who did that?
There were notes taken of the call.
May we have those notes?
No.
Why not?
Why should you have them?
I'll tell you, we got to end this, but I'm going to write a letter to Mr. Mueller, and I'm going to ask him, is there anything you said about that conversation he disagrees with? And if there is, he can come and tell us.
Right.
So the hearing is now over.
And if
Senator
I
Blumenthal,
just...
I promise you, that if there's any, Mr. Mueller will have a chance to make sure that the conversation relayed by Attorney General Barr is accurate. And I'm going to give him a chance to correct anything you said that he finds misleading or inaccurate, and that will be it.
Okay.
And that was South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham, who's chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. In breaking news, the Associated Press is reporting that, according to two people familiar with the matter, Attorney General William Barr has told the House Judiciary Committee members that he will not testify on Thursday. He was planning 2 days of testimony. Apparently, he has canceled after today's testimony, 5-hour testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and has said that he will not testify on Thursday in continuing hearings. And one of the most tense moments in the hearing came when Hawaii Democrat Mazie Hirono accused Barr of lying to Congress and demanded his resignation.
You should never have been involved in supervising the Robert Mueller investigation. You wrote a 19-page unsolicited memo, which you admit was not based on any facts, attacking the premise of half of the investigation. And you also should have insisted that Deputy Attorney General Rob Rosenstein recuse himself. He wasn't just a witness to some of the president's obstructive behavior. We now know he was in frequent personal contact with the president, a subject of the investigation. You should have left it to career officials. Then, once the report was delivered by the special counsel, you delayed its release for more than 2 weeks. You let the president's personal lawyers look at it before you even deigned to let Congress or the public see it. During the time you substituted your own political judgment for the special counsel's legal conclusions in a 4-page letter to Congress. And now we know, thanks to a free press, that Mr. Mueller wrote you a letter objecting to your so-called summary. When you called Mueller to discuss his letter, the reports are that he thought your summary was giving the press, Congress, and the public a misleading impression of his work. He asked you to release the report summaries to correct the misimpression you created, but you refused. When you finally did decide to release the report over a congressional recess and on the eve of 2 major religious holidays, you called a press conference to once again try to clear Donald Trump before anyone had a chance to read the special counsel's report and come to their own conclusions. But when we read the report, we knew Robert Mueller's concerns were valid, and that your version of events was false. You used every advantage of your office to create the impression that the president was cleared of misconduct. You selectively quoted fragments from the special counsel's report. taking some of the most important statements out of context and ignoring the rest. You put the power and authority of the Office of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice behind a public relations effort to help Donald Trump protect himself. Finally, you lied to Congress. You told Representative Charlie Crist that you didn't know what objections Mueller's team might have to your March 24th so-called summary. You told Senator Chris Van Hollen that you didn't know if Bob Mueller supported your conclusions, but you knew. You lied. And now we know.
And that was Hawaii Democratic Senator Mazie Hirono. And again, breaking news from the Associated Press, according to two people familiar with the matter, Attorney General William Barr has told the House Judiciary Committee members he will not testify on Thursday. Two people familiar with that matter told the Associated Press, which is just being reported today as we are on the air at this moment. So after the hearings on Wednesday, Senator Kamala Harris tweeted, "What I saw from the Attorney General is unacceptable. Barr must resign now." And we'll be continuing this coverage in the days to come. Next month, later this month or next week possibly, Special Prosecutor Mueller will probably be also before the Senate committee to testify. I'm not sure, Senate or House committee to testify on these issues. In more news, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was sentenced to 50 weeks in British prison for skipping bail back in 2012 when he sought asylum inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Assange stayed within the embassy for 7 years until his arrest last month after embassy officials said he violated their hospitality. He faces possible extradition to the United States on conspiracy charges, as well as potential charges of sexual assault of a minor in Sweden. Last week, it was announced that U.S. Border Patrol would be fingerprinting some migrant children under 14 years of age, reportedly over concerns about fraud and trafficking. Now officials will also start doing rapid DNA tests on minors and adults at the border in order to establish family relationships. Reportedly, the Department of Homeland Security will begin the pilot program next week. It will run for 2 or 3 days at 2 unnamed locations along the border. And in other major headlines, Florida teachers can now legally carry firearms into school, according to a bill touted by state representatives as a safety measure against potential mass shootings. And in North Carolina, public school teachers walked out for the second year in a row, calling for higher pay for veteran educators and a restored salary bump for teachers with master's degrees. New York City became the first major U.S. city to implement free phone calls for all prison detainees. The change is a result of past city council legislation, 741A, which shifts the cost of calls from families and lawyers to those detained onto the Department of Corrections. And detainees will be allowed up to 21 minutes of phone time every 3 hours to anyone within the continental U.S., and calls will be limited to 15 minutes at a time. Those in solitary confinement will be allowed one call a day for up to 15 minutes. The high cost of phone calls has been the subject of recent growing criticism by prison reform and rights advocates. And the latest coming across the wire as we speak, thousands mourn for Puerto Rico at a May Day rally. Thousands of Puerto Ricans marched to the rhythm of traditional music and tambourines while opposing austerity measures, with many demanding the ouster of Federal Control Board overseeing the U.S. territory's finances. Protesters in San Juan also called Wednesday for much faster federal help in the island's recovery from September 2017's Hurricane Maria. Many in the crowd waved Puerto Rican flags made in black and white rather than red, white, and blue to symbolize mourning for the territory's plight. Participants also urged the local government to save a public pension system that faces nearly $50 billion in payments it doesn't have funds to cover. A protester dressed as comic book superhero Spider-Man was arrested after jumping over a street barrier and hugging a police officer. And finally, a new report by the nonprofit Coalition for the Homeless found that the number of New Yorkers in homeless shelters hit a record high of nearly 64,000 people a night in January. The coalition criticized Mayor Bill de Blasio's Housing New York plan for not doing enough to get the homeless off the streets, saying that in addition to building new units, existing units must also be preserved. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, May 1st, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Heather Chin. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo.